Welcome back to WordBalloon.com, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, we talk to writer Mark Verheiden, who has pop culture credits that run the gamut of mediums, from films like Time Cop, The Mask, and an upcoming collaboration with Bruce Campbell, to television shows as an executive producer on Smallville and Battlestar Galactica. Mark's comic credits are just as diverse, from his years with Dark Horse Comics on his creator-owned project, The American, and movie adaptations of Aliens and Predator, to his current association with DC Comics as he takes over the Superman-Batman title this June. Our conversation begins with a look at the start of Mark's comic writing career. Was Dark Horse your first publisher?
Yes, they were definitely my first publisher.
And was The American your first comic book work?
That was my very first actual comic script I ever wrote.
I enjoyed the series. It was fun to see the collection that came out last year.
Yeah.
A very interesting series that ran several years, and I remember seeing it on the stands. It seems that it ran intermittently. Is that correct?
It was fairly intermittent. We were sort of at the mercy of our artists and also at the mercy of my schedule, because as I got busy, it became harder to dive back into the different books I was working on, depending on the book. But yeah, it was an intermittent series, pretty regular from about 1988 to about 1990-something, and then we did a mini-series in 1992, and I did a few little short stories.
Is the collected edition then the complete run?
That is absolutely, I believe, every page that I ever did of The American. And that collected edition was a long time coming. We've been trying to get that out for about 3 years now. So I was really happy that Dark Horse was finally able to put it together and get it out.
It's a parody of its time, and it reflected a lot of political ideas that were going on. But I'm also pleased to say that I think it still reads very well, and I enjoyed the idea of a kind of Captain America character and your take on him and putting him in, the real world.
Well, I was always, I'm actually intrigued when I took a look at it again. It had been a long time since I'd actually looked at him. And the original stories were all sprang out of the Iran-Contra hearings back in the Reagan era. And the idea of an Oliver North type character who stood up as a hero. And people have different views on politically on how you may look at him. But I didn't really see that too heroically, and so that combined with sort of the Chuck Norris missing in action movies that were coming out at the time, where we seemed to be re-winning and Rambo re-winning the Vietnam War, those were what really sort of galvanized the series in a general sense. And then the fact that I always have loved patriotic superheroes, Captain America, it just seemed like a chance to do my version of that. But what's amazing is when you think about it, it really hasn't aged much. In fact, it's sort of more of its time now, maybe, than even then.
You bet.
Because things have gotten, I think, perhaps even more cynical in terms of the wars we're in and battles we're fighting.
And media manipulation of the facts as we get them. No, I completely agree. I think you're right. I think that's one of the reasons why it was so much fun to read even now.
Yeah.
So was the American a Canadian title that you kind of revised, or
no? We made all that up.
Okay, cool.
I thought it would be fun to create this false history that, which got more and more insane as we went on. But the idea that there was this primitive comic book company in Canada called Watch Fob, which sort of sprang off Timely, which was the early Marvel comic.
Sure.
And it got really insane to the point where the only reason this guy and Watch Fob was printing comics was because he had his own paper mill that churned out paper that had huge chunks of wood in it, so it made it very difficult to get good color. And the mythos went on and on and on. And it was funny, too, because I remember at the time I said, this is just fun, and surely no one will think there's actually a Watch Fob. But in fact, I got letters from people that said, yeah, I've been looking for these comics, and I can't find them anywhere. And I remember, I guess, very vividly one guy being kind of irritated that when I said, oh, it's kind of a joke, man, and he's like, whoa, how dare you? So that was just having fun.
Well, and it's great because it, much like something like Watchmen, provides a backstory, this fictional backstory that you've created. So it's pretty neat.
It just felt like a way, I think Alan Moore did it better, but it was just a way for us to have really just fun, bring in different artists. I love Golden Age books, too, so it was kind of a chance to do the Golden Age look in a couple pages here and there. And That was fun.
I really enjoyed the series, and I absolutely recommend people to seek out the trade. Again, yeah, it came out either at the beginning of this year or late 2005.
I think it was late 2005. It's quite a bargain. I think it's almost 350 pages, and it's like $12 or $14 or something like that.
You did other Dark Horse runs as well. Did you do Predator stories and Alien stories?
I did the first three Alien series that Dark Horse put out, and I did the first Predator and then a couple others that came a little later in the run. These are all like 4 or 6 issue story arcs.
During this time, did you start to get some TV and film work? And is that one of the reasons you started doing less comic book work?
Well, the way it happened was I moved to Los Angeles to do film work, and I moved down here in the early 80s and wasn't having an enormous amount of luck, although I did sell a couple screenplays and actually had this really bad low-budget movie made in the mid-80s called Terror Squad, in which terrorists invade Kokomo, Indiana, Illinois, or some guy.
That was a Chuck Connors movie.
Chuck,
right?
Connors, that's right.
There you go.
I have a story credit on it because I learned early on you get rewritten. And what happened was then some friends of mine in Oregon went and started Dark Horse Comics. Of course, they do it right after I move away. And I began doing a lot of work for Dark Horse even while I was in Los Angeles. And to make a long story short, what basically happened was when I did the Predator comics, I got a call from Joel Silver's company. And he said, wow, I like these. Come on in and tell us more about what you're doing, because we want to make Predator 2. We'd like to hear what you're doing with the comics. We may use some of that. So I went in and met Joel Silver and told him what I was doing with the comic. And at the same time, I pitched them The American as a movie, and they bought it. And so that ended up being my first studio screenplay, even though they didn't make that movie.
I see.
And from there, I started doing much more work in film and quite a bit later, television. But I started writing screenplays, and I did Time Cop and
yes.
The Mask and several other things, and a bunch of scripts that didn't get produced.
And shows like Freaky Links as well.
Yeah, that was kind of later. That was 2000 or so.
Okay.
My first actual TV show that I had anything to do with was the Time Cop TV show, where I was thrown in off the deep end. I had never done television, and Universal and ABC... Larry Gordon, who's the producer of Time Cop, sold them a Time Cop series, basically sight unseen, with a 13 on the air order, which is unheard of nowadays, and said, you want to write the pilot? And I'm like, yeah, sounds good to me. So wrote the pilot and produced that show. So that was my first TV adventure. That was in like 96, 97.
That's cool, and I know that that's popped up again on Sci-Fi Channel on occasion.
Yeah, they're running the sprockets off that, baby. We ended up making 9 episodes, got canceled after 9. It was quite a learning experience.
Wow. Well, let's get back to The Mask, which was a great adaptation and a great vehicle for Jim Carrey, and it's hard to imagine anybody else playing The Mask, even though they tried, of course, with Jamie Kennedy.
Yeah.
Were you involved at all with that Son of the Mask? Good for you.
No.
Great movie, and, you know, of course, Cameron Diaz, my God, what a great debut in that film.
She was great. The funny thing is Jim Carrey was nowhere on my radar when I did my pass at that. I think early on, people we were talking about included like Rick Moranis. I'm trying to remember who else. That's the main name I remember.
Okay.
Was he might have been very good. Shows how long ago we were working on it. But Jim Carrey, I barely on my radar back then. I only knew him. I think he was on In Living Color then.
Sure.
But I think we were all stunned when, in sort of the middle of production of The Mask, Ace Ventura came out. He just went through the roof. So that was just lucky happenstance in terms of getting him.
That was a great movie. And
thanks.
Who directed that?
That was Chuck Russell.
And also incorporating kind of the animation components, almost in a Roger Rabbit sort of way.
Yeah, kind of. I think our template was always more Tex Avery.
Sure, Looney Tunes and Tex Avery.
You know, with the eyeballs popping out.
You
and,
bet.
That was a lot of fun, and yeah, that was a lot of fun. It's funny though, in movie screenwriting, I did the second pass on that, and that was it. And the things I added were like the dance number.
Oh, cool.
Cuban Pete.
Sure.
In fact, it's kind of funny. It's the only time I've had this happen. A friend of mine played me a 78 record of Desi Arnaz singing Cuban Pete that he found at a garage sale or something, and I went, man. And I was working on The Mask then, and I said, that's a song that The Mask should sing. And I actually attached a tape of Cuban Pete to the script when I sent it in to New Line, and to my astonishment, several years later, here's CDs and Cuban Pete, and it was very funny.
That's really cool, and it absolutely evokes that Desi Arnaz orchestra feel.
Yeah.
So you nailed it. I mean, that was fantastic.
Just seemed right.
And back to Time Cop. I mean, you know, one of the Van Damme movies I think that stands up despite the glut of Van Damme movies that there have been.
Yeah, that was an interesting project too. We started pitching that in 1991, and that was a project we did with Sam Raimi. So he was sort of the first producer to attach himself. Now this was just around the time of Dark Man, I believe. But with his help, we got it to Larry Gordon, and it was in development for, I don't know, maybe a year, but it was one of those, actually in film time, very speedy, I think from pitch to being out, it was about 4 years. Another little funny casting story, though, I remember when I was writing it, and I liked Van Damme in it, I thought he was fine, but I had in my head Kurt Russell.
Oh, cool.
This would be a great Kurt Russell movie, and of course the studio's like, Kurt Russell. Can't sell a movie. No good. You know, no, we'll never put Kurt Russell in a film. Well, I think Stargate came out about a month after Time Cop and went through the roof.
Wow, yeah.
And we said, well.
Woulda, coulda.
There, but for the grace of God.
Moving to your DC work. Now, you worked with Smallville before working with DC Comics, correct?
No, actually, I started with DC way back in the 80s. I did some comics from them. I actually even did a Superman comic back in the 80s. I didn't do a lot of work for them, but my very first regular comics job was a good friend, Bob Greenberger at DC, hired me to write The Phantom.
Oh, that's great.
Purple guy on the horse.
You bet.
And
Lee
that
Falk
was enough
character.
To get me out of my day job and start writing full-time. So I've always been grateful to DC and to Bob for that.
Which incarnation of the Phantom, what time period did this story take place?
Modern. It was modern
times,
and I was trying to do definitely a modern times version of him with pirates, but modern day pirates.
Sure.
And I remember I did one on toxic dumping in Africa. I did a lot of research on sort of what was going on in modern Africa then. I did one about kids who do this insane thing called, or did anyway, this insane thing called train surfing, where they would get on the roof of a locomotive and ride it like a surfer. But the problem is there's low-hanging power lines and stuff, and so these kids were being decapitated left and right. And so the Phantom stopped that, for crying out loud. That lasted for 13 issues.
Who was your artist on that?
A guy named Luke McDonald.
Okay.
Who,
I remember Luke McDonald, absolutely.
I thought did a fantastic job.
Very cool. I'm a big Phantom fan. In fact, Moonstone, the company that currently holds the license, I think they do a lot of good Phantom stories as well.
Yeah, very nicely done.
Very cool.
I was always proud when I got done. I got a nice little letter from Lee Falk saying he thought I'd done a very good job.
Wow. Well, there you go. Get it for the man. Absolutely. Yeah. So let's talk about your take on Superman then. You did have a chance to write him, you say, in the 80s.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Okay. Well, I was curious because writing on Smallville, I know Alfred is it Alfred and Miles?
Alan Miles, yep.
Okay. I know that they're big comic book fans. It seems like getting guys like yourself and Jeff to write, and it always seemed like your guys' stories, given the credits that we see on the episodes, seem to tie in a little bit more to what the comic book fans would, you know, connect with Superman. Specific episodes like Red and Perry, of course, things like that.
Right. Well, I think we brought some of that sensibility to it. I think, you know, to be honest, I'm not sure I was hired so much for my comic book background. I hadn't really done many comics for, oh, I don't know, 5 or 6 years when I went on to Smallville. And here's an odd aside in how the world works. Al and Miles were story editors on Time Cop.
Oh, wow.
That was how we met. So we had actually worked together on another show called The Strip when they asked me to come on to Smallville. So we go kind of way back, and it's not just the comic book thing. But obviously it was great to have a chance to work on Smallville. It's a different take on it. And I remember, you know, when they first started, I was kind of going like, well, this no tights thing will last about 10 episodes, you know. But, you know, they had a very clear vision of what they wanted to do with that show and a very clear vision of how to sort of reinvent the myth without destroying it. And I think it was, you know, the decisions they made were just so incredibly smart to keep Superboy out of his uniform, so he's just Clark Kent. Perhaps most brilliant thing, I think, was making Lex and Clark friends, and then that we see the tragedy of how their friendship comes apart, and Younger Parents was a good idea, too. So I just thought they reimagined it really brilliantly. The pilot they wrote is one of the best pilots I think I've ever read.
I agree, and I think it shows on screen. It really is one of the best debuts for a show. I mean, that really was great. And as you say, the sympathetic thread that runs through Lex Luthor and really becomes the tragic character of the show. And, you know, we all know how it's going to end with Luthor, but we really do kind of feel for him, and you can appreciate where he's coming from in a lot of his decisions.
Yeah, he's the guy you really are watching because, you know, Clark Kent, with his red diversions and stuff, he does have his issues, of course. he is the hero, and ultimately that's not going to change. But Lex is a man of choice, you know. That character has choices to make. He can be good or he can be bad. Clark, I don't think, has much choice. He's going to be good. But Lex is such a tragic character. You know, he wants to do good, and he's just so torn. He was really fun to write.
I'm curious, too, about the Adam Knight character that came in your last season with the show. And I know that the rumor was that the guys were trying to figure out a way of bringing Batman onto the show, and then there was a big debate on whether they could or not for legal reasons, or whatever decisions Warner Brothers was going to make. You tell the story in terms of how Adam Knight evolved and what it finally ended up being.
Boy, Adam Knight.
Am I wrong about that?
Now, is he the one played by...
Ian Shaughnessy?
Summerhalder?
Okay, there we go.
That fella?
Yes.
I don't think that had anything to do with Batman.
No?
No, I think that the whole Batman thing was certainly something that was raised, and it was like, wouldn't it be fun to have Bruce Wayne come to Smallville? I don't think we ever, and I could be wrong, I'm not privy to all those conversations, I don't think that went beyond the talking stage. And so Ian was hired to be Lana's boyfriend. And that quickly turned into Lana's nemesis.
Sure.
So but bottom line, I don't think the Batman, he was certainly never hired intended to be Bruce Wayne, as far as I know. I don't recall that ever.
Okay, I think...
He was always intended to be this fellow that we wanted to bring in, another sort of obstacle for Clark when it came to Lana.
Sure.
And so that was where that character came from.
Now, when I talked to Jeff Loeb, he told me that after a while, it seemed his value to the writing staff was being, as he put it, a guy in the room helping to break down stories rather than, you know, being as involved with, you know, going off in the corner and writing your own scripts.
Right.
What was your role in the Smallville writing staff?
Well, it depended on the year. I mean, by year three, I was co-executive producer with a fellow named Ken Biller, and we, I guess, co-ran the room, we would break the stories. I did quite a bit of rewriting that year.
Okay.
And I wrote two episodes the last year. I wrote five episodes the first year. So it's an interesting business because sometimes I felt like I did more writing probably in year three than I did the other 2 years, but it was rewrites, and my name didn't go on those scripts.
So you guys were the showrunners?
No, Alan Miles was the showrunner.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, but you were running the writer's room.
When they're, you know, when you say running the writer's room, it's in when they're not there.
I gotcha, okay.
Usually how it works is whoever's sort of the second in command, you know, you work on breaking the story, which involves just figuring out what the story is beat by beat, you know, mm-hmm. what's the teaser, what's act one, and working all that through, and then you would pitch that to Alan Miles. They would, you know, make changes or sign off on it or whatever they would do, and then we would take it to the next step, which would be to get the studio and the network to sign off on it and to assign it to a writer. And so a lot of steps to get it to script, actually.
The third season, I think, was really one of the best of the run so far because that's when the Kryptonian mythos really started to come into play. Having guys like Christopher Reeve show up
right. And
being part of the story, there were a lot of really memorable episodes from that season.
Getting Christopher Reeve was very chilling and wonderful. I mean, chilling just in that awe-inspiring, getting that shiver down your spine. Wow. I never got to meet him because those scenes were all shot in New York. But it was watching the dailies with him was just amazing. And I'm so glad they got him on the show. And then the other one I was really happy with was Michael McKean as Perry.
Yeah.
Perry White. I just thought he did a great job, and that script was probably my favorite of all the ones I did.
And a very funny script in a great way, and the last way you'd expect to be introduced to Perry White
is kind of
a Schlockmeister, journalist.
Reporter. Drunk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's, again, the great thing about Smallville. You know, familiar names, but definitely new spins on a lot of the characters, creating three-dimensional people and much more interesting people than, you know, just your typical cigar-chomping Great Caesar's Ghost. At this point, you know, time for something new for Perry, so it was cool.
Yeah, it just seemed like a fun way to bring him in. There are Superman purists who have a real problem with anything that deviates from the mythos. I always say to them, the comics are still there.
Sure.
We're not going in and erasing them and making them different. I mean, Smallville is Smallville. The comics are the comics. The 60s comics will always be the 60s comics, if that's your favorite era. So...
Well, let's talk about your Superman run for DC. First of all, I was disappointed, as much as I'm happy to see the new guys on it, and I'm a big fan of Jeff, and I'm a big fan of Kurt Busiek as well. I thought you and Greg Rucka in particular did a great job on the time that you guys had on it. I think the guys at Action kind of juggled back and forth, but no, the two of you guys had a very two stable runs, and, you know, very clear understanding of the Superman character.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. It was a little more abbreviated than I would have hoped. I signed on as all the sort of Infinite Crisis stuff that's going on was revving up, and found out pretty quickly that there was this plan for the, I think it's happened, the 1 year later and all that.
Yes.
That just sort of led to my abbreviated run. It was sort of like one day I found out you're doing nine, and I went, oh, when did that happen? But they were very gracious. Eddie Braganza and Dan DiDio, they're both wonderful to work with. And they said, we need to pull you off Superman, but would you like to do Superman-Batman? I said, yeah, that sounds pretty good.
That's cool. And it seems like Superman-Batman is a book that won't be as tied to continuity.
It is not. We are doing stuff. Actually, I say that. The first issue I did, which is drawn by a guy named Kevin McGuire, is a one-off that is tied into continuity.
Okay.
But the next arc I'm doing, a six-issue arc with Ethan Van Shiver, it's tied to continuity in that we're not actively trying to negate anything that happened in 1 year after. You know what
okay.
I mean? Like, if a character has changed appearance, for instance, during 1 year after, we will reflect that in our stories.
I see.
But in terms of rigorously saying, well, Superman couldn't be here because in 1 year after he was actually, you know, on the planet Venus or something, no. We don't have to worry about that as much.
Okay.
So it's its own sort of independent, insane, over-the-top arc.
Was it part of your idea for the storyline that you did in Superman proper, the idea that people started to fear Superman, was that an idea that you had to do to kind of set the table for Infinite Crisis, or was that something that you were running with yourself?
That was something I was running with myself, and it's the interesting world of mainstream comics. When I started doing that arc, I had one story in mind, and quickly, because of Infinite Crisis, I had to sort of do a U-turn.
Okay.
And so some of that, I'm pretty happy with the stories I did for it, but there's a little bit of ambiguity in terms of the characters within the stories themselves that I had to sort of retrofit when I found out I'm not going where I thought I was going to go.
Okay.
That's kind of a long answer, because the truth is, yes, I wanted them to fear Superman, but there may have been a slightly different outcome.
I see.
But we got just sort of caught up. And I say caught up, it was great to be part of Infinite Crisis, the build to that. So caught up in that, and that's fine.
And I also enjoyed the South American Fortress. I thought that was an interesting location.
Yeah, that was actually set up in the Azzarello run, but I just wanted to, you know, take it further.
Oh, okay.
And we just played with that.
So. Okay, because, yeah, it seemed like it was like moving day.
Yeah.
When you took over.
Yeah.
And good interaction of, you know, it's so weird because they have been characters for so long in the books, but always tough to get a handle on Jimmy Olsen and Lois sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you had no problem with either of those characters.
I love both those characters. They're really fun. And I think the key to them is to you know, there's a certain amount of fun of being associated with Superman, you know, that, you know, wow, we hang around with the most powerful man in the universe. And so you don't want to get them all down on themselves all the time. And also, Lois just sees him as this dude, you know. she's not, on the one hand, gosh, sure it's funny. Hey, fly me somewhere. Yeah, all right. But on the other hand, it's like, do the dishes, for crying out loud. She doesn't treat him as a god figure or something like that. She really treats him like a husband.
Right.
With all the good and the bad that is.
Did you and Jeff ever sit down and have any long discussions about philosophies behind Superman?
Well, we spent 2 years in the room together on
sure.
Smallville, so we talked about super stuff endlessly. In terms of just Superman in general or the comic book version, not really. He was sort of doing his thing and I was doing mine. And to be honest, when you work on Smallville all day, the last thing you want to do is go out and talk more about Superman. No, we didn't.
Okay.
You know, we did some, and Jeff's been a good resource, especially when I started Superman. I could ask him questions. Obviously, he's over at Marvel now, so doing his own thing, new thing. But,
absolutely. You know, early in the Smallville run, it sounded like people gave young Clark a Peter Parker kind of that kind of component to the Clark character.
Uh-huh.
Did you ever think about that, or did you ever encounter that kind of criticism or even just comment in terms of the way you guys were portraying young Clark?
I don't know about Peter Parker per se. I would say that there was a
kind of a guilt complex.
Well, certainly that. I mean, the sort of like I've been gifted with these powers, and there's a great weight and responsibility. So in that sense, in the, you know, with great power comes great responsibility thing, yes, that absolutely is a part of the Clark Kent persona. I would say we got more reaction to where, though not necessarily this guilt thing, but like Red was quite a reaction, because I think a lot of people felt, not a lot of people, but some fans felt that having him go that far in his alternate personality, which was a very dark personality where
sure.
he actually was robbing things,
yeah.
was maybe too far. I liked it. So
I liked it, too. That's surprising because, yeah, I mean, Red Kryptonite has been a part of the story for so long, and how do you do that in a realistic way but still have, you know, some component of the fun of Red Kryptonite? And I think you guys came up with a good balance.
Right, yeah. What we didn't want to do with Red Kryptonite is, you know, have him grow an insect head or
exactly.
you know, get overweight or, you know, or whatever the hell that happens. You know,
you bet.
We wanted to, you know, do it in, you know, it's sort of like it was like take the Superman mythos but then do the Smallville version of that. What would happen in our world as opposed to sort of the comic book world.
Now, for Superman, Batman, and I know you can't get into much detail, and I can appreciate that. I'm
yep.
one of those people that want to actually read the stories. I don't look for spoilers.
Right.
But thematically, how do you think this will differ from your run on just the Superman Monthly?
Well, I think that Batman's a much darker character inherently than Superman. So so this we'll be exploring their friendship to some extent, and their friendship is one that's not equal, I don't think. I think Superman's a much better friend to Batman than Batman is to him.
Okay.
Because Batman is afraid of him. Batman is always worried that Superman, if he goes off the you know, loses it, he could split the Earth in half. Batman loses it, he could do some damage, but he's not going to break the world in half.
I gotcha.
So there's an element of that. That makes it sound kind of dark, though. The real thing I'm doing with Ethan is this is no spoiler, but we're going to be bringing back a whole bunch of absolutely unexpected Silver Age-ish villains, creatures, even heroes, and using them in a bunch of crazy ways. And that's been really fun. In the first issue, I think we have Dr. Phosphorus.
Okay.
There's an old Batman villain.
Sure.
We have the original Doomsday, who I believe is dead. So that's curious.
Okay. Well, actually, he was in Infinite Crisis.
Oh, was he? Okay.
Yeah.
And then his name is, of course, I mix these names up. They all, you know, Doomsday, Slaughter Guy. and we also have Titano.
Oh, great.
Super Ape.
You know, and I saw the preview art for that. It looks fantastic.
Yeah, he did a great job on that. So there's more of that coming, and some of the more unexpected. And I think you'll find that one of our villains is sort of like the most unexpected villain that only the most diligent Silver Age, Golden Age DC fan will ever guess could be. But I love that old stuff. So,
and I was going to ask, are you? I assume you're a fan then of the old World's Finest runs.
World's Finest, House of Mystery, House of Secrets. I have an almost complete run of Strange Adventures.
Oh, that's great.
You name it, I love that stuff. I love Silver Age Batman. The crazier, the better. you know, Zebra Batman.
Sure. Zebra Batman.
I love it.
Oh, yeah. What about any current books that you're a fan of?
Right now, let's see. You know, it's funny. I read, obviously, tons of DC. It's almost like when you said, you know, when you get done working on Smallville, do you talk about Superman? And you don't. It's when I get done working on the superhero books, I go out and read stuff like Acme, Novelty Library.
Very cool.
I love 8-Ball, Dan Close. I think he's great. Anything by Alan Moore.
Okay.
What else have I gotten recently? Oh, there's a guy named Ivan Brunetti who does Schizo.
Okay.
He's brilliant. A lot of Fantagraphic books, a lot of, trying to think, Drawn and Quarterly. So the smaller press stuff I love.
That's really
and,
neat.
Not out of snobbery, I just love it.
No,
love it all.
Hey, that's great. No, and believe me, I always say the same thing about radio. It's like, you know, working at a hardware store all day and then diving into a pile of nails when you get home from
right.
work. No,
right.
I completely understand that.
Busman's holiday.
Well, let's talk, unfortunately, because I know you're in the Battlestar Galactica studios, but I'm going to force you to talk a little bit about Galactica because
I'm here.
What a wonderful show.
Well, thank you.
And congratulations to all you guys because I think you've got an amazing writing staff around you, and I think Ron Moore and David Icke are doing a great job. What is your role? I know that you've written a few specific episodes, but I know you're also listed as one of the co-executive producers.
Right. Yeah, I'm co-executive producer. But basically, I came in about 6 episodes into season 2 to help out and was made co-exec fairly soon after that. My job on the show really is to run the room when Ron and David aren't here. And
okay.
They're often up in we shoot in Vancouver, B.C. Our offices are in Burbank, California. So they're often up on production. So I will work on breaking the stories, again, with their input, and they vet everything and make it better. And then I write episodes, and then I rewrite episodes.
Well, and two in particular, first The Final Cut, the mm-hmm. Lucy Lawless episode.
Right. That was my first one for them.
And a very inventive piece. And, you know, I find Ron's podcast commentaries incredibly informative.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting to hear some of these behind-the-scenes details.
Right.
Specifically on The Final Cut, which was a documentary-style, you know, almost like a war in progress covering the men in the field, how things are working.
Right.
And there were so many interesting visual choices, and one of them, which is a motif throughout the show, that the corners of anything square seem to be cut off.
Right.
And it was so interesting to see that in this letterbox format, that too was a visual choice.
Right.
In the documentary footage.
Yeah.
Was that a director's choice or was that a writer's choice?
Oh no, that was a Ron and David choice.
That's terrific.
No, absolutely. We talked about they sort of talked about it, you know, it's like, well, for whatever reason we decided the edges of the paper would be cut off like that, you know, in the miniseries. I think if you picked up a piece of paper just to make it, I guess, look different.
Sure.
So then they thought, well, if we're shooting the documentary, maybe they do that there too. And that's really where that came from. I love that kind of thinking, you know, that carries those motifs across all aspects of the show and not just one. And gives it more of that sense of reality because it's also connected to itself. That was a great choice from them.
And was the idea behind the episode, was that your idea?
No, I came in actually and they basically, Ron and David, said we kind of want to do the Day in the Life episode. And we broke it. The idea there was to, I think, give a little more time to some of the cast members that hadn't really been able to step out from behind their jobs, you know, like Duwala, who often just answers the phone, or Felix Gaeta, who
yes.
as often just answers the phone, to just flesh those out a little bit. And then because it's not a relationship show per se, then we also wanted to do some sort of spine of a story that had Jeopardy, and so that was the story that involved Colonel Ty being threatened by the guy that was mad at him over sending troops over to a civilian ship that ended up in sort of a Kent State massacre.
Yes, the martial law moment.
Yeah, the fellow that did it was angry at Ty for having sent him over, and the guilt he's feeling he can't deal with, so he turns that against Ty.
Well, it turned out great, and I also enjoyed the other two that you wrote this season, Black Market.
Thanks.
Black Market was great because, to me, it tied back to the original series, and that's what I like about the show because it is a reimagining, and that phrase is so overused. But what I like is there is a lot of thematic nods to the old series, and it almost seems like it was in the pilot where there was that kind of concern about. Well, where's everybody going to get these finite, you know, set of supplies,
right.
And how are you going to distribute them around the fleet?
Right.
And it was this very interesting problem that was being handled in this episode.
That really was the genesis of that, was to think about the sort of real supply line issues that would occur on the fleet. And it seemed only natural that people would take advantage of that. I mean, one of the great things about Battlestar is that it's not the Pollyanna-esque future that you may expect from a science fiction television show, although there's others that have been dark. I think we take dark. We go dark.
Yeah.
So to explore sort of, you know, my theory of people in the fleet is, you know, the Cylons are out there and they're terrible, but in an odd way at this point we're our own worst enemies. And so that was an episode exploring that. That sort of concept.
Very cool. And you co-wrote the season 2 finale?
Co-wrote that, yep, with Anne Coffell.
I'll spoil in terms of the show has been shown. So you make this very dramatic shift in, much like DC Comics, 1 year later.
It was such a weird coincidence. And people have asked me, you know, did one suggest the other or did you rat it out? Or I had nothing to do with it. They were both independently arrived at, trust me.
Well, and I mean, now we've got President Baltar, which is wonderful. And, yeah, all the juxtapositions of characters.
Yeah.
And people, much like they are asking about D.C., how these new relationships are established. But now all of a sudden, Colonel Ty and Starbuck, who literally have thrown punches at each other, are now wonderful, great friends.
Yep.
And everyone just dealing with life on New Caprica, the chief being married to one of his old crew.
Right.
I mean, it's fantastic. Fat Apollo, fat Adama,
right.
and just a great way to leave everybody wondering what the hell just happened and what the hell is going to happen next. Congratulations.
Well, thanks. I mean, I think Ron has said it best. He said he wasn't quite sure if it was the craziest or bravest thing we ever did on the show. I happen to think it's the bravest and the coolest. That shift was part of our planning for a long time. So. It's not like it came out of the ether, I mean, or just was some sort of, you know, last minute, hey, let's try that. We really worked toward it and thought about it. And I think it's just, again, when you work on series television, so many times you're about just sort of redoing the same show with a different flavor. And Battlestar is not that. Battlestar is about how do we take you to new places where you're going like, whoa, where did that come from?
And also, I think, getting back to the bravery that you guys are showing, too, is to, you know, stick with a storyline beyond a two-parter. Mm-hmm. And they did that, I think, in the first half of the second season, building off of what happened in the cliffhanger of the first season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it took seven episodes to really get the fleet back together.
Well, that is another fun thing, is we'll pull characters out of the first season and put them in. I mean, you know, you'll say, oh, let's use that guy, and see if he's available as an actor, and you know, so it's, we're not, again, it's just a very freeing sort of way to work, because it opens you up to so many more story possibilities and choices, and when we're working on a story, our main concern, at least mine, when I'm sitting there, is like, in fact, it's funny, a lot of times I'll go like, ooh, that kind of scares me, that's good, you know, when you get to that place, you go, ooh, I'm not sure about that, I'm unsettled. I must be good then. And they're not always good. But I'm finding that when we get to that point where you're going like, I'm kind of not, then you go, might be one to explore then. So, again, not the standard hour drama television experience. It's usually you're a little more locked down, and it's sort of like, are you crazy? You're going to jump ahead a year? Are you nuts? You know, think if, you know, Law and Order did that. Well, I guess it wouldn't matter.
That's true.
They're all just still sitting there.
Well, compared to Smallville, which, given the end results of the episodes, looks like, you know, it was a very successful writing staff.
Mm-hmm.
Can you compare the two rooms in terms of the creativity that you're seeing now working in the Battlestar room?
Well, everything's different. I mean, I think, you know, they're just such different shows. And Smallville, good question. I'll tell you one thing. I felt like the Smallville stories were harder to figure out than Battlestar, which may sound odd, but maybe it's just because Battlestar is so sort of you can do anything.
Okay.
And it felt like the Smallville stories were harder to figure out, harder to just get those twists and stuff. And I'm not sure why. It might be my limitations. I don't know. But the main thing I remember is that Smallville was a lot of breaking story and working on making sure that the season was progressing. And Battlestar is all that, but it's also a lot of writing and being on set and things like that. So it's just different. Different shows have different ways of operating.
Okay. Who are your favorite characters on Galactica to write?
Well, Baltar is always fun.
Sure.
He's got that attitude. Well, I got to say, Starbuck is great to write.
Okay.
I mean, they're all great to write because they're all so different. But Starbuck has such an attitude, you know. It's always fun to write characters with attitude because you're going to get your own sort of, you would never say that, but she can.
Well, and she pulls it off. I think that's a credit to Katie Sackhoff because that character could so easily, and I think even in the pre-hype for the show, I think people were really ready to hate Starbuck.
Right.
At everything she represented because she wasn't Dirk Benedict.
Right.
For old-time fans. But I really think that this cast in particular, and again, your guys' writing and the directors as well, I mean, you guys are charming the pants off of us, so I think we don't have a choice. And I'm really, if there are any detractors left from the old-school Galactica, I don't know what to tell them other than you guys don't know what you're missing because congratulations on the Peabody. I mean,
well, thanks.
My God. I mean, that is there.
Amazing.
That's the highest thing that is. Am I correct? The highest award, really, that television shows can get?
We were certainly impressed. we think it's fantastic. It's wonderful to work on a show that's so critically recognized. I mean, and what's interesting is in the same week we got rave reviews from the New Yorker and from the National Review, where I think that's the one. National Review is the right-wing one, right?
I believe that's correct,
yeah.
Yes.
I
only know The Nation,
yeah.
Being the bleeding art liberal that I am.
Right. I have to admit, I don't pick up the National Review every week myself. Pick that one up. But what's cool is that we don't seem to be alienating any... People can't discern our political leanings from the shows.
Sure.
You will derive from it what you will, and I think it's because we do not set out with any agenda. We set out to write interesting stories and to explore what characters might do in these very stressful situations, and so we're not actively trying to promote any kind of political agenda. But it's funny because it's such a political show.
Well, yes, and getting back to the episode that you co-wrote in the season 2 finale with the election of Baltar and Roslyn, and you've certainly there are echoes of 2000 in that storyline.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think you present both sides, and also the concern of, look, you know, whether we like it or not, this was the choice. Whether it's the right choice or not, the people made that choice.
Right.
So I think there are elements of every side to those political arguments that you guys explore fully.
Right, and because it's science fiction and because it's set in another world, I think no one gets their ox gored, you know.
It's, sure.
Same with the religious stories we do. We're not saying anything Catholicism or Christianity or Muslim faith or anything like that. We're saying these are the faiths in this world, and this is how people deal from those faiths. And so the great fun of that is to be able to explore different themes that would be very controversial if you were doing them, I think, in America. In quotes.
Right.
But because it's separate from that, you're able to take that one step back. You're able to get that distance. And when you have that distance, you're able to explore it, and people don't get as offended. They're actually a little more open-minded about seeing how it plays out. And I think we make an attempt, too, not to demonize anyone, any side, too much. We may pick a side occasionally, but I found it fascinating, and I love the plot thread of Laura Roslin being the one who cheats in the election.
Yeah.
The most moral, upright, we need civilian rule person, and she cheats and gives Baltar the moral high ground. I mean, what a... Oh, you just hate when that happens.
Or the abortion episode as well, which,
yeah.
Again, I think was handled very well, and every side was represented, and you can appreciate where everyone was coming from in that argument.
True. Yep.
No, I think you guys, whatever you got, whatever you're drinking over there, keep it up.
Just the water.
It's working. Well, it's definitely working.
Good.
Well, and I know you can't say anything about next season, and I can appreciate that.
I probably shouldn't.
And I respect that. That's okay. We will look forward to further developments in October. I also look forward to the expanded episode of the first half of the second season,
right.
The Phoenix.
Right.
And or rather, the Pegasus.
The Pegasus.
Yes.
Right.
And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that at full length.
I think it'll be fun. Yeah. Obviously, we've seen those cuts, and it's crushing sometimes what has to be pulled out. So it'll be great to see them restored to some extent.
So is Moore going to pull you into a podcast next season?
I don't know. That's up to them. I'm fine. I just do my thing. I don't know. Actually, you know, the funny thing this year is since we're debuting in October, I think we're going to be done just about with the 20 episodes by the time they start running. So,
have they begun shooting the new stories?
Yeah, we're just getting ready to start episode 3.
Okay.
So we are shooting away.
That's great. That's really great. And I'll ask one question, and if you can't answer it, I'll respect
sure.
that. But I think there was confusion, I think, in the last commentary that Ron and David did, if Ed Nolmus is coming back
or not.
He's
coming back.
Okay, and good. I'm glad you said that, because it sounded like you guys, they were being flippant.
They were joking.
And that's exactly what we thought. Okay.
Right.
But I know some people are like, oh, no, they said it.
No,
so.
He's back. That's no spoiler.
Well, and again, the caliber of these actors as well, I think, is elevating this material.
Yeah, he's so great. He's so great. You get the stuff back and you just go, oh, my God. Wonderful to watch.
That's terrific. So, you know, I know you've got Superman, Batman coming up. Are there any other comic book plans in the future?
Well, no. Right now, between Battlestar and Superman, Batman, I'm plenty busy. And,
is it tough juggling the two?
Yeah. it's just juggling the comics, and I love doing them, but because Battlestar is sort of the main the main job. So
yeah.
I say yeah. I mean, they're great fun to do, and you move them, you get them done when you can, and great problems to have. All I can say.
What characters haven't you had a chance to write yet in comics that you would like to?
In comics?
Yeah,
that's interesting. I always wanted to do Batman, so I'm glad I'm doing him.
Cool.
I have to say, I always loved the Fantastic Four. I've only dallied around with Marvel. I did an epic book for them years ago. Never did a mainstream book. The Fantastic Four is great, and they were always a favorite. I guess that would be my answer.
Okay. What was your epic book?
My epic book was called Stalkers.
Okay.
It came out like in 89, 90. We did about 12 issues of it, kind of an insane little project that didn't make too much of a bump, but it was fun to do.
That's cool.
Creator-owned. We own it. It's back to us.
That's cool.
Actually, a guy just reprinted some of them, sort of like the American book. A guy named Dave Elliott did a reprint of a story I did with an artist named Disraeli, who's an English artist, has a very unique style. That came out last summer, I think.
Oh.
Summer of 2005, or this is 2005.
Okay. What was the name of the publisher?
I think it was a division of Boom Studios.
Okay.
Or A1, maybe.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember. I know Ross Ritchie is friends with, I get confused.
All those Boom Studio guys, they're very good. They have a lot of interesting projects coming out.
I don't want to say it was from Boom. I don't think it was.
Okay.
I think he was helping out Dave Elliott on this project or something. Not sure what the genesis of it was, but it came out. That's all I know.
Any films coming up?
Yes, I have a film shooting.
Oh, yes,
in
you
July.
Do. Yes, and shame on me, because we should talk about it. Please, by all means.
I have a film called My Name is Bruce that I've written that stars and is directed by Bruce Campbell, shooting in July. Low budget, but fun. And he plays himself, a sleazy B-movie horror actor, down on his luck, drinker, about the worst person you can imagine, who is kidnapped by a small town who mistakes his Ash persona for reality and thinks he can help them fight a monster. And when he gets out there, he's celebrated and feted, and he thinks it's a present from his agent, so he's thrilled. But probably the the key scene is when he actually gets out there and is trying to fight the monster, and he goes, "It's real," and starts shooting. And he's so bad, he shoots more villagers than the monsters, and they're saying, "Stop shooting! Stop shooting!"
So, how did you hook up with Bruce?
Actually, I've known through Sam Raimi, had met him a couple of times. He actually did an episode of Time Cop.
Okay.
The show everything revolves around.
And man, you got a lot of those 9 episodes, man.
Yeah. So we knew each other sort of tangentially, but basically I got the idea for this. I'll tell a short little story. I love old comics, and there's this old comic from DC called The Adventures of Alan Ladd.
Okay.
The actor.
Yes.
And they were so surreal because they're actually stories about the actor Alan Ladd. And it was like he's on his set one day, and mean guy comes out and says, "Come with me, Alan Ladd," and hits him on the head. Next thing, he's on a pirate ship shoveling coal. And the pirate says, "Ha, ha, ha, look at the great Alan Ladd now." And you're like, "This is bizarre. Did Alan Ladd read these?" And I thought, boy, take out Alan Ladd, make that Bruce Campbell. That would be a very, very funny idea of the real Bruce Campbell going off on these adventures. And so basically Dark Horse has a deal where they could make some low-budget films, and I pitched it to them, and Dark Horse loved it, and so that was it.
That's terrific.
About as easy of a deal as you could make.
Well, and it sounds like kind of like Galaxy Quest, too, in terms of...
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, the actors kind of being forced to face something their characters would normally face.
Right, although not, in my case, Bruce is certainly not the hero. He's the trembling weenie. And what's great about Bruce is the more you deride him in the movie, he loves it. He's great.
I think that comes through on screen, absolutely.
The sleazier and the whinier, and he's kicking the crutches out from people and stuff, the better he likes it. So he's very funny.
That's cool. And yeah, you know, it's almost like with Bruce Campbell movies, you're like riding shotgun with him.
Yeah.
And it really is kind of like, you know, as opposed to looking directly in the camera, you know that he really is talking to you as well.
Right.
So I think that's great.
He's very funny.
So when does that potentially come out?
I'm not sure. I mean, we're shooting it in July.
Okay.
And everybody should just keep their eyes peeled on the internet, because I'm sure we'll do a push on it when it's ready. But I would guess sometime in 2007. But,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. You know, hey, we'd love to have you back and talk about the film, and also when you are able to talk about season 3 of Galactica.
Sure.
That'd be terrific. And honest, man, I loved your Superman run, and I wish you luck on Superman Batman. I'm looking forward to reading it.
Well, great.
So continued success, and
okay.
I appreciate your time.
All right, thank you.
That's Mark Verheiden. Don't forget to look for Superman Batman debuting this June for DC, his film They Call Me Bruce later this year, and coming back in October, the 3rd season of Battlestar Galactica. And that'll wrap things up for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Keep coming back to Word Balloon for updates on upcoming episodes. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2006.